So, Professor Esfeld received his PhD from Harvard University in 2010 for inventing a synthetic microbial ecosystem that rapidly evolves useful biomolecules. He then went on to help pioneer the development of a powerful new method of genome engineering based on CRISPR, the enzymatic scalpel that can be programmed to cut DNA at any desired sequence. In 2014, Kevin and his team were the first to outline how CRISPR could be used to build evolutionarily stable gene drives capable of altering wild populations of sexually reproducing organisms. Recognizing the potential implications of a unilateral method for reshaping shared ecosystems, he and his colleagues detailed ways to control, block, or even reverse changes made by gene drives while emphasizing the importance of safeguards to ensure that they do not accidentally escape the laboratory. To set an example for future research in this field, they chose to reveal their findings before experimenting with CRISPR, so that public notification and discussion could guide their research and safeguards. Because there is little precedent for deciding whether, when, and how to use technologies that can affect entire communities, Kevin seeks to establish a new model of open and responsive science that allows communities to guide the development of powerful technologies. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kevin Esfeld.
All right, well, thank you so much for the kind introduction. This talk is about malaria, but is also about, of course, what comes beyond malaria, because while malaria is very important, it's not necessarily the end goal. However, it is the subject of an interesting scenario in which we have dramatically improved the situation when it comes to malaria. We have saved 3 million lives by spending $18 billion. And that means $6,000 per life over 15 years. The reason why GiveWell recommends that we give to Against Malaria Foundation is they have best practices, so it's even more efficient than that. The problem is that from here on out, the problem of combating malaria is only going to get harder. And that's because 15 countries make up 80% of the remaining cases. These are the ones that have improved minimally over the past. So bed nets, indoor residual spraying are less effective because the mosquito burden is just so great. So what are we going to do next? One option is to remove the vector. And we can do that potentially with gene drive. Gene drive works by engineering the genomes of wild mosquito populations. And we can build them using CRISPR. We introduce into the mosquito's germline DNA encoding an altered gene of interest and the CRISPR system necessary to make that change. That is, we program the mosquito so that it can do genome editing on its own. Once one copy goes in, then it will cut and edit the other chromosome. Now, this mosquito having two copies, when it mates with a wild counterpart, all of the offspring are guaranteed to inherit a copy of the altered gene. And in those mosquitoes, editing happens again. You go from one copy to two copies, which means that all offspring will inherit. Editing happens again. On and on down through the generations, you're running a find and replace on the original sequence with your new one. So this is gene drive. This is a particular form of gene drive. And since we first described what it could do, it's been demonstrated in four different species. Two of those are malarial mosquitoes, including the primary vector. There are several different things that we could do to solve the problem of malaria with gene drive. We could alter the mosquitoes so they can no longer carry malaria. We could suppress the populations so that we turn them all into males, or spread female infertility so the population crashes and there's not enough of them to transmit, or even potentially drive them extinct, at least locally. Option three, and my personal favorite, we do both. The problem with this form of CRISPR-based gene drive system is that once you make one and release it, it keeps going. That means that there's a very high probability that a single released organism with a CRISPR-based gene drive system will eventually alter most organisms in the local population, and eventually every population of that species everywhere in the world. That's why we refer to CRISPR-based gene drive systems of this type as global drives. And that's a major problem. Because how do you safely run a field trial? How do you even release them in an area with, say, barriers, nets around a village where you want to release them but keep them from getting out and spreading, when a single mosquito that escapes for any reason is enough to loose an uncontrolled, from that point on, change through the population? If you can't run a field trial showing that it works, showing that there aren't any side effects, how are you going to get everyone to agree? And what are you going to do if people decide that they're not comfortable with this? Obviously, there are severe ethical issues with forcing a change like this on people who haven't given some form of informed consent. How does informed consent work when it comes to entire communities? It becomes a question of governance. Consent is not a given. In fact, because this technology involves genome engineering, we're starting at a disadvantage. While 88% of scientists say that current GM crops are safe to eat, only 37% of the public agrees. Similarly, 67% believe that scientists don't have a clear understanding of the health effects of GM foods. And this is in the United States. We're biotech friendly here. Europe is much more skeptical. And Africa is more like Europe. In 2002, Zambia rejected GM food aid during a famine. And apart from South Africa, of the sub-Saharan nations, only Burkina Faso currently grows GM crops. So convincing people in these regions that even solving a problem as great as malaria is best done with a gene drive system is always going to be an uphill battle. And if they don't agree, that's a problem, not just morally, but practically, because gene drive systems, while they will spread indefinitely, spread slowly. And because the drive system would take many decades to spread throughout all of Africa on its own, if you only released it in a handful of countries, then we need local communities to release their own. And if they're unwilling to do that because we rush things, then we could end up losing net lives to malaria. Malaria is not the only problem out there. If we blow it with malaria, what about the other things that we could use gene drive to solve? 250 million infections, more than malaria, widespread cognitive and growth stunting, and somewhere between 12 and 280,000 dead. This is schistosomiasis. Two species of parasitic blood flukes cause this disease, two species that could be eradicated with gene drive systems. But the regions where schistosomiasis is worst are exactly the same regions that we might be interested in using a gene drive against malaria. So social or diplomatic rejection of gene drive, because we handle malaria wrong, could mean that we delay schistosomiasis eradication. The upshot is millions of lives, quite literally, will only be saved if we get this right, if we somehow navigate this passage of social acceptance with rapidly getting the technology out there in as safe a manner as we can. And of course, it's not just global health and development. That might be what we care about most, but we can also use this to save endangered species by controlling invasive ones. We could revolutionize agriculture. Instead of spraying chemicals to control insects that eat our crops. We could narrowly reprogram the pests so that they don't like the taste. But all of this requires popular acceptance. And the reality is that when it comes to popular acceptance, perception is everything. And that means that perceived benefits and the process by which we are introducing this technology are tremendously important. So we have a scale of two extremes. On the left, you have technologies that have minimal benefits and are introduced in ways that lead people to be skeptical. On the right, you have the polar opposite. Part of the reason why we have such a problem with GM crops is that they are a case study in how to do things in such a way that people distrust you. The hope is that we can do gene drive in the opposite way, that we can learn from the experience and start with applications that offer clear benefits. Yes, malaria and schistosomiasis are some of those. Develop it by nonprofits, remove the profit motive suspicion from the equation, ensure that discussions come before experiments, that we talk about safeguards, and that science is open and responsive from the get-go. That will maximize our odds. But we don't necessarily want to start with malaria and schistosomiasis. That's where the most good can be done with the technology directly, but informed consent is hard in a lot of countries, especially those that have lower levels of education. How do you know that people really understand what the risks are? How do you get diplomatic consent when there is no regulatory apparatus? The Gates Foundation and others interested in this, most researchers are aware of these challenges and they're working around it, but not all. And there's always the risk that people will say, how dare you bring in your radical new technology and test it on people who can't possibly give informed consent? So partly to address that, we want to encourage some of the people who are the wealthiest and most privileged in the world to volunteer. So what we proposed in the last couple of months was to release engineered mice onto Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. Hundreds of thousands of engineered mice. And the idea is that since ticks pick up Lyme disease from the mice, if the mice are all immune, then there's no infected ticks. No infected ticks means no infected kids. And we're starting without any gene drive system on a small uninhabited island, at least that's the plan. And if the results look good, then the communities on Nantucket and the Vineyard can vote and decide whether they want to move forwards. If they do, then we might have the option of moving to the mainland. Not with a full global drive system, but we would want something like a local version that would allow communities to make decisions about their own environment without imposing them on others. And we have a scheme that might allow that. If enough communities like that, then we could move on to a global version. And this intermediate step could be key. Our current best idea, hopefully we will come up with more, is what we call a daisy drive, in which we separate the components of the drive system into an interlinked daisy chain, and the one on the end doesn't drive. So you can think of it as a multi-stage genetic rocket that constantly loses links as it spreads until it runs out and stops. The problem is, no matter how careful we are in selecting an ideal problem and ensuring that the process is as optimal as we think it can be, community guided from the start, we approach the communities before running any experiments, seeking funding or anything, building in stopping points at which they must consent before we proceed at all. Everything is at risk from a single misstep. And that's again because of the nature of gene drive. What we don't want is something like this. After we released our description of what gene drive could do and released results in yeast, another group independently, unaware of our work, developed it in fruit flies. Not as a gene drive, not as a method of engineering populations, but because they wanted a way to quickly knock out two genes in a single fly. And they published it using a name that, well, I would not have chosen for popular acceptance. And they published it as a method to be used for other groups. And they very nearly did it without mentioning the need for safeguards, even those that they used, even though they used pretty good safeguards, because they weren't thinking about it in that context. They just didn't know. And the risk, of course, is that you would end up with something like this. Imagine the consequences, in terms of public confidence in science, of a spreading wave of genetically engineered organisms, year after year, invading new cities, nations, continents. You'd get headlines like this. And our hope of using this technology for good would diminish with every new newspaper. So we did manage to head that off. We talked with them. These are brilliant scientists. They're very well-meaning. They got it. A bunch of us got together to recommend safeguards. But we still, again, can't guarantee that anyone will necessarily read this. Anyone who can make a transgenic sexually reproducing organism can, in principle, make a CRISPR gene drive. And this leads to a broader question. If science was done in the open, if everyone described what they were going to do before they did it, then we would have monitored what was going on, and we would have been able to contact them and say, hey, this is dangerous, and what you want to do can in fact be done more safely. You could separate the components of the drive, and it would actually be easier to knock out both genes in a single step, and it would be safer as well. But we couldn't do that because we didn't know what they were doing. No one knows what anyone else is doing in science. The system is set up to incentivize secrecy. Why? It's slower. It's slower because we don't know what other people are doing. And that means we can't find optimal collaborators. We can't find people who have the other key piece of the puzzle. We fall into the same stupid traps that other people have fallen into, but don't share because no one publishes their negative results. It's less fun. You never know whether you're wasting your time because someone else is doing exactly the same thing. Students live in fear of being scooped by another lab, having their careers tanked. It's less trusted by the people. Why should people trust us when we insist on running our experiments behind closed doors? But perhaps most relevant, is the box. That is, I would argue that closed-door science is more dangerous because it means we don't know what other people are doing, and so the people who do care about potentially dangerous technologies have no way of knowing when someone else is working in an area that might be dangerous. The power of new technologies is steadily increasing, and we need that. We need new technologies. Civilization is not sustainable. We all know this. But researchers cannot reliably anticipate the consequences on their own. And that's the key, on their own. Collectively, we have a better shot. So, as it is, I would say it's only a matter of time before someone opens a dangerous box, whether that's just an accidentally released gene drive, an accidentally released pandemic virus, or something potentially even more dangerous that we can't even conceive of right now. So, if science were open, could we avoid that? Is it better to have science open by default? Would that reduce global catastrophic risk? I don't know the answer. I suspect it is true. And that's very important, because if it is true, then it suggests that we must change the way we do things. Because right now, we are tinkering with the life support systems of the only ship we have, and we're doing it in the dark, unaware of what other people are doing, unable to comment and make suggestions on it in real time. It's not because we don't have the technology to turn on the lights. We can do that now. That's what communication technology has given us. We haven't adapted science to make use of that. So the question I have for all of you is, should we do that? Because if we should, then gene drive is the technology that should lead the way. Because for both moral and practical reasons, it is most likely to succeed if all of the research is done in the open. And if we can change the incentives to favor open gene drive research, then it's that much easier to change the incentives for the rest of science. So I would submit that the single most important application of gene drive science is not malaria or schistosomiasis or any other direct application. It is the potential to change how we do science. Because if open science is safer, it's also almost certain to be faster. And it's not very often that we have a chance to make a change that would accelerate progress while also making it safer. If we have it, I think we should take it. So, what do you think? That's all I've got. Thank you very much to my group. Thank you to the organizers. And thank you for your time and attention. I'd love to start a conversation if you're interested in this. This is an area where I think EAs can do a great deal of good by helping with engagement. Many of you have skills that are relevant to communication with the public through various means. We could use your help. If you're at all interested, please contact me. Also, we don't know if this is actually a good idea. What do you think? Please share. The whole point is we're all smarter together than we are alone, at least if we manage this intelligently. So let's figure that out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So next up, we're going to have a little fireside chat here, and we're going to incorporate some of your questions into the discussion as well. To help facilitate that, I'd like to introduce Jenya Dana. She is a senior science policy officer in the Office of the Science and Technology Advisor to the Secretary of State within the U.S. State Department in Washington, D.C. She advises on emerging biotechnologies and international policy issues, is a negotiator on science, technology, and innovation in multilateral organizations, such as the United Nations, and works to advance science, technology, and innovation for sustainable development with a focus on Africa. She grew up on a small family farm in Mississippi, discovered a love of science in high school, and took a circuitous path from the lab to the foreign policy world, having spent time in the financial sector, with an agricultural policy NGO, and a think tank working on governance of emerging technologies. Her scientific training is in ecological risk assessment of emerging technologies and stakeholder engagement in risk governance, and she conducted her doctoral research in South Africa. She has a master's in public policy and a PhD in conservation biology, both from the University of Minnesota. Please join me in welcoming Jenya Dana.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Jenya.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Just for the audience, Kevin and I have worked together on thorny policy questions around biotechnology for several years, particularly around questions of international risk governance. So what I saw you describe on the stage was potentially a pretty powerful new method for going after some pretty serious problems facing humanity in terms of infectious diseases. And those are real problems right now. But what I also heard you say is that it sounds like we should be taking it slow. How do you reconcile the urgency of dealing with something like malaria with your proposal that we actually can't move that fast? We have to do some groundwork first. Why shouldn't we just go ahead and try to get this technology out now as fast as we can?
That's one reason why I hate malaria, because there is no good ethical solution. We either sacrifice informed consent, democratic process, and public confidence in science, or we sacrifice a bunch of kids. There's no good answer. But I think that in this case, if we try to rush it too fast, if we decide, you know what, we're going to save the kids no matter what. We don't care about country's consent. We don't care about diplomacy. We're going to throw it all out the window. We have fleets of drones. They don't have control over their airspace. We're going to fly our drones dropping mosquitoes out the back as they go. Really? First of all, morally, are we really going to be comfortable with that? I think that would have some policy implications beyond just malaria. And we would have to do that because no one would be willing to use this again if we're going to run roughshod over them. I mean, what's that going to do to all of our other development efforts? What's that going to do to next time? Because schistosomiasis is going to take longer than malaria. So I think that in this case, the science will be rolled out faster if we don't simply push ahead as quickly as possible with the global drive system. I think that developing small-scale local interventions that prove that it works and build confidence will ultimately get us there faster.
So can you say a little bit more about your work then on Nantucket? Because it looks like you are going through the process, albeit it may be a slow process, of engaging communities around discussions on how to proceed with this technology. Do you feel that the community can help you, say, for example, determine an optimal technological solution to one of their problems? Or do you think they maybe throw something back at you that you wouldn't have chosen or isn't really, you know, the most salient or expeditious way of getting at the problem? What if they say they don't want this technology after all?
Well, there is always the fact that there's nothing that sends a stronger message than that we are worthy of trust than agreeing to walk away when they say no. So I think that that would be very valuable in and of itself if they did say no, to set the example that say, yes, we will walk away. We will drop this. If people don't want it, it's really up to them. It's their children. It's their yards. It's their lives. It's not our business to go in and tell them what is optimal. That's why we have democratic governance to as our shared optimization system. Mm-hmm. I've been amazed at the positive response because I hadn't really grasped just how much people care about who is doing it and why and what the process is. But it makes sense because to many of us, it's all too easy to simply say, well, just look at the data. The data should decide. But most people don't have the time or the expertise or even the access to the data to do that. So they ask these other questions instead, which are the relevant questions if you want to draw on the expertise of others. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of genetically engineered mice. And yet at these two public meetings, there was not a single person who said, no, I'm not, I definitely don't want to see this move forwards, even though several people walked into the meetings with that attitude. So I think it is a potential path forwards. And I think we are more likely to come to good deployments of technologies that can improve the world if we ask people if they want it first. Would you rather have them tell you no early on when you can adjust the technology and propose something slightly different that they then like better? Or would you rather hear them say they're not going to go for it during the public comment period when you've already developed it completely and submitted it to the regulators? At that point, it's too late.
So that brings up a really interesting point, though, about how to do sort of a go, no-go decision. And you've pointed out that your philosophy on this is that, and tell me if this bleeds over into a lot of different technological fields. I mean, we could talk about this for AI, we could talk about this for geoengineering, we could talk about it for any number of emerging tech fields. Do you think it's better to co-develop the solutions with the communities who are going to accept these technologies, or should we be relying on the expertise that may come from the technology community or the scientific community, who in theory, some would argue, knows better?
Well, again, if you do everything in the open, then you can have both. You can draw on the expertise of both the scientists and the local people. And of course, it's the local people who know what they want. And the more choices you give them, so in this case, we can either immunize the mice against Lyme disease only, the spirochetes, or against tick saliva, which then blocks transmission of a bunch of other tick-borne diseases, or we can do both. And so when we put this to the community, they overwhelmingly said both. I mean, that's something that you don't know until you go out and ask them. And similarly, what do they want to look for? What would make them comfortable in that initial field trial on an uninhabited island? What should we be looking for? Mm-hmm. Right? We can say, have the ecologists tell us what is necessary. You're an ecologist. I'm sure you have many ideas of exactly what we should be looking for. But from my perspective, I care at least as much what the communities think, because ultimately theirs is the go, no-go decision. Mm-hmm. And if we can run some tests, even if you don't think they're important, they do. And frankly, they live there, not you. Mm-hmm. And I am not so confident in our ability as experts to recognize everything that is important that I'm willing to discount the opinions of others just because they don't have degrees. I think that insofar as we do have a failing as we develop our fancy new technologies to improve the world, it is that we are insufficiently humble when it comes to our ability to predict the negative consequences relative to those of everybody else.
So I want to ask you then, based on that philosophy that you've described, and it feeds into one of the questions that's trending here, and that is about the practice of science and open science. What is your definition of open science? Is it science that is community-driven, co-created, or is there something else that you think the scientific community should be reorienting towards?
I would favor structuring the incentives for all grant proposals to be open, which would have some benefits to us. If you just wrote one grant for one project, put it out there, and any interested funder could fund it.
Are all of yours open?
What's that?
Are all of your grant proposals open? How do you practice your transparent science?
All of our proposals to use GeneDrive in any way are open, including detailed safeguards and what we plan to do and why we plan to do it. And yes, we're putting up all of our grant proposals relevant to GeneDrive. We're not doing it yet in other areas of science, because I think there is an overwhelming importance to do it for GeneDrive, for, again, moral and practical reasons. That's not necessarily as true for technologies that don't allow a single individual to unilaterally impact the lives of others outside the lab. And there are very good reasons why most scientists aren't open with respect to their responsibilities to their students, because once you've reached the level where you are running your own lab, it's not so much your career on the line. Okay, I don't have tenure yet, so I guess it is. But with my students, it really does matter, because they're devoting years of their lives, and if they get scooped because we disclose what we're doing and someone else picks it up and does it quicker, make no mistake, the world is better because it got done more quickly. But that could be it for a student's career, and so we have responsibilities to our students. We need to change the incentives if we want more widespread change. And that means changing recognition by journals or whatever ends up replacing journals if we change that, and encouraging funders to require the research to be open. If funders simply required every grant proposal to be made public, we'd be most of the way there. Not entirely, because of course the ideal situation is you write grants for things you've already done, but we'd be a lot closer.
So we're at the end of our time here, but what you have just outlined does tie back, I think, to the presentation that we saw from Kari Tuna earlier, where they were talking about the practice of science and whether there was more that could be done in that area to reform the incentive structures that you're talking about, potentially in an era of such technological promise. This becomes an even more pressing kind of question. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jenny.